Like now, like especially like someone like you or I who does stuff on YouTube, you know that if you say something and it's not true, you got to go back and say, hey, this is what I thought. This is why I thought it. But now I know that this isn't true.
Yeah, you know, when a guy makes a mistake, you should probably own it. I mean, I made a few in my life. As a matter of fact, I made a couple when I was talking to Joe. Now, I know that that flies in the face of all known human logic. The idea of Dan Richards making a mistake. Come on, guys. I mean, this is ridiculous. But it does happen. And we're going to talk about a couple of them here. It's kind of embarrassing, a little egg on my face. But in addition to that, we're also going to discuss the Kill Tony show that I went to. I'm not going to spoil any of it or tell you what happened, but I will talk about how awesome it is to be at the after party and what kind of things you can expect to experience if you are a VIP at the Kill Tony show. I know it's amazing. They accept freaking redneck lumberjacks into the freaking VIP section at the Kill Tony show as long as Joe Rogan knows you. It's a wild and crazy world up here in 2025. Well, sit your ass down and I'll tell you all about it. Hi, my name is Dan. Welcome to Dunking.
The thought is that if this Ark of the Covenant is there, and it, whatever it is somehow radioactive, is there any sort of theory as to how they develop some sort of radioactive thing? Like what is it supposed to be? I mean, it's not a reactor, it's in a box, yeah. Right? Like what is it?
The theory that a lot of people have is that it's a weapon that like in the Bible it's described like shooting lightning and things like that,
right?
And what Graham mentions in the book, it's an interesting point, is the Bible records Moses going up to Mount Sinai, coming down with the Ten Commandments, getting mad at the Israelites worshiping a golden calf, and he breaks the Ten Commandments and then goes back up the mountain and comes back down after another week or so with the Ten Commandments again. And Graham points out that this could be a memory of him going up and getting the wrong stone and then, damn it, smashes it, goes back and finds the right stone that he's looking for, that it had the proper, you know, uranium rich or whatever speculative radiation stuff. This was also said to, after going up and seeing God, he was said to have had to cover his face with a cloth for the rest of his life because it was shown. And Graham speculated in that book that it might be because of, you know, radiation sickness or something. His face was covered in sores for the rest of his life. As I said, I do make mistakes sometimes, and here's one of them. The Bible says that Moses' face shone with the glory of God, but it doesn't specify how long. So maybe the rest of his life, maybe 14 seconds, maybe 38 minutes, maybe a week, maybe 2 months. Who knows? At any rate, I misspoke. But inside of the box, a popular theory is, you know, if you've got metal, wood, metal, like a transformer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the popular theory is it's a way to generate electricity. And it would also describe like the way that guys in the Bible are, if they touch it, they have to carry it with sticks. And if they touch it even to steady it, they get killed and stuff. But I honestly don't see it being a transformer. That wood metal or metal wood metal thing has to be stacked. You're not just getting it with one layer like the Bible describes. But it's an interesting thing.
When you say it has to be stacked, you mean spaced in between each layer?
Yeah, like if you've ever seen a doorbell transformer.
No.
Okay, transformers at the bottom of it will have multiple plates. And it'll be like a plate of metal and then a plate of silicone or something like that conductive, non-conductive. And there'll be multiples of those. And this is part of the electromagnetic changing of the because what a transformer does is it steps electricity up or down and swaps voltage for amperage, basically. So the metal plates are part of it. So the idea is that this thing would collect electricity inside the box, and then the Israelites would use it to throw lightning at the enemies.
Okay, this confused a lot of people, and I understand why. I mean, most people nowadays that are into this stuff would claim that the Ark is a capacitor, not a transformer. But many used to claim it was a transformer, and that's where my mind went first. Here, take a look at this picture real quick. They utilize stacks of conductive and non-conductive material frequently. This is an almost ubiquitous feature, at least on a transformer used in small-scale applications, that kind an electrician like me is apt to handle frequently. Now, the capacitor is a different beast. You only need one layer of non-conductive material between the two layers of conductive material. Even air will work as a non-conductive material. So you can have conductor, air, conductor. And a capacitor could potentially work if the spacing's right and everything. The problem with that is the capacitor needs a power source. It doesn't just make electricity, it stores it and then discharges it. So you would need a power source. So my electrician-y brain immediately was like, as always, like, you got just a dead box here without something to feed it. So I always end up going to the transformer or to a battery or something like that to start the process. And then I look at the arc. So yes, the most modern interpretation from the ancient high technology perspective is that the arc is a capacitor. However, as a capacitor, it would not function as such. All right, let's just be blunt. If the arc is a technological device, just to assume that it is, the description of it is woefully inadequate in the Bible, and you have to flesh it out with a bunch of stuff that we only know from the modern day.
Some guys believe, like Billy Carson would say, that the Ark of the Covenant would fit inside of the sarcophagus of the King's Chamber, which it doesn't, and that it's a capacitor to power the pyramid. So
it doesn't. How do you know that it doesn't?
But the Bible has the specifications for the size of the Ark of the Covenant, and they're not the same as the
How different are they?
Considerably.
Is it larger or smaller?
The Ark is larger.
Oh, it's larger
quite a bit
than
larger.
Oh, really?
Okay, the measurements of the Ark wasn't something I expected to be brought up, but let's go ahead and look into them. The interior of the sarcophagus of the Great Pyramid is 77 by 26 by 34 inches. And the Ark of the Covenant, well, it's said to have been 45 by 27 by 27 inches, making the Ark far too short to, like, accurately fit in the sarcophagus, and a touch too wide to fit in there as well. So I was a little right. It is a little bit too big, and that was what really clued me into the fact that there's no effing way that these two things went together. It's just too damn big, but it's also way too short. So me and Joe were both right, but I've got the bigger beard, so...
And there's a lot to be said, like, that you can't see about ancient Egypt that's amazing. Like, you know, the Bronze Age collapse, you've heard of that, right? Mm-hmm. And the Sea Peoples. Egypt was, like, the big power that survived. Like, all these other big powers, they were destroyed. They were crushed. They lost everything. Now, Egypt got smaller, but it survived. It wasn't until the Greeks came along that it was, I mean, they'd been conquered off and on, but it wasn't until the Greeks came along that they were truly subjugated.
Now, I missed a beat here. The Persians under Cyrus the Great did conquer the Egyptians, and the Egyptians expelled them via rebellion, and they came back about 50 years later, and the Persians were in charge of Egypt when Alexander the Great came and kicked all of them out and then reconquered Egypt for his own purposes. And even some records say that the Egyptians considered Alexander the Great a, like, liberator or whatever, right? Probably accurate. At any rate, I missed a few beats, but the bottom line was still the same. The Egyptian mechanism, the Egyptian way of thinking, the way of worldview, the way of life, the government, it survived the Bronze Age collapse. It survived a lot. It was very robust compared to its contemporaries. That's what I was getting at.
I should have airdropped this to Jamie. I'll send it to him in a second. There's a image that I've got of that I was just sent to me that's pretty amazing. There's a wall of one of the magazines in one of the pyramids that has a bunch of those vases in it. And this wall is like that collapsed. And the magazine is the name for a room. Anyway, they reconstructed this room. They reconstructed the wall, and it's got a piece of one of those vases in the fucking wall, like right in the rubble that makes up the wall. And I could not.
Now here's the image. Yeah, check this out right here. I got this from Adam Young, part of the Vase Scan Project with Ben Van Kirkwick and all those guys. And I just want to thank him very much for providing it. And I will be covering the provenance issues, or lack thereof, on these vases in an upcoming video. But for now, this is what I wanted to airdrop.
Which one of the things I wanted to bring up to you was the Baghdad battery.
Yeah. Something that's worth noting right there is that archaeologists have determined that, well, yeah, I mean, we don't like to admit it, but yes, these potentially could have been batteries. So, like, there was a guy that did a debunking on it that's a popular YouTuber, and another archaeologist came around and kind of slapped him around a little bit, and he had to admit, he's like, okay, yeah, I didn't do my research good.
But because of what, I mean, this is not speculative, right? Because of what the actual materials are, if you filled it with a minor acid, it would conduct electricity.
Yes,
so it does work.
Yeah, it wouldn't make a lot, but it would make a little.
Like how much is a little? Like enough to power a toothbrush?
I don't think that much, but I know that the reports anyway was that a guy was able to make a very minor electroplating with it.
Now, this is kind of fun. Like Milo from Mini Minuteman, who... You know, there was a time I would have mentioned him when I got this kind of platform on the JRE, but right now is not one of those times. Sorry, buddy, but you've got enough followers, and I have no desire to send you any more. Anyway, Milo was, he's quick to say that the Baghdad battery's a bunch of bullshit, but archaeologist Brad Hofford came along and was like, he's a real archaeologist, not like Milo, where he took a couple of classes and, like, flipped a couple of spades and doesn't know that you're not supposed to sit on the freaking artifacts at a site, or you're not supposed to touch them and shit. Archaeologist Brad Hefford, he knows better. And he's quick to tell Milo, you know, Baghdad battery, well, it could actually have been a battery. And this is something archaeologists don't want to admit, but the reality of it is the thing has been tested numerous times. The things have been tested numerous times. If you introduce a alkalite or a electrolyte, excuse me, a low-level acid like a vinegar or a orange juice, you will create, not can, will create an electrical charge with the Baghdad batteries. Now, you can put a number of them together. You can't daisy chain them, which is electrician pseudo term. A daisy chain means you like wire them together. You can't do that for long distances, but you can stack all these bastards right next to each other, daisy chain them all together, and use them to electroplate something, and this has been done. Now, there are no electroplated artifacts in the record that we can find from back in those days. Now, keep in mind that electroplating is a very thin layer of metal that you can rub off with your fingers in about 20 minutes. But point is, there is no artifacts that prove that they were electroplated back in those days. However, if you don't have a better explanation for these clay vessels than being a battery, if you can't explain the reason that they have the lead and the copper in them, I'm sorry, your explanation's shit compared to the Baghdad battery explanation. And this is from somebody who's not a big fan of ancient high technology. I don't think they were using these to power light bulbs. Light bulbs require a whole lot more tech, but these work as freaking batteries, man. What do you want?
The craziest theory of all, for sure, is the Christopher Dunn. The Christopher Dunn theory about the actual pyramid itself, he believes it's a massive power plant.
Mm-hmm.
And he believed that they were using some sort of chemicals and a certain frequency of like vibration to generate hydrogen with all the chambers and all. And, you know, the way he describes it, it sounds very compelling. Mm-hmm. Because there's, I don't know what he's talking about. He might be making it all up, right? So the way he's saying it sounds so interesting. I've never heard anybody try to break down whether or not what he's saying makes sense, though.
Well, now I like Chris. I get along with him well. I talk to him on the phone probably a couple times a month. He knows that I disagree with him. The thing that right off the bat, as an electrician, the first thing that stands out to me is the claim of getting piezoelectricity from the blocks, which piezoelectricity is the electricity you get from like a quartz crystal when you stress it. So like your watch or a charcoal igniter for a grill, right? The igniter is just a piece of quartz that they pop it with a little spring and a stick when you pop it. And it's got a piece of metal on each side and wires, and that harnesses the charge. That's the first thing, is each one of the quartz crystals in those big limestone blocks would have to have a piece of metal around it and wires coming off of it, or some way of harnessing the electricity.
Like the day this podcast aired, I got an email from Chris saying, "Hey, Dan, good job, but you missed something here, buddy." And he posted a quote from one of his books that he's given me all of his books, but I admittedly have not gotten through them all yet. I'm sorry, I've been freaking busy the last month or three. But at any rate, what he had to say was this: "Regarding your discussion pertaining to the Giza power plant and piezoelectricity, I would ask you to turn to chapter 2 of Giza, the Tesla connection. On page 39 to 40, I wrote, in the Giza power plant, I described the King's Chamber as a resonant chamber that, because of its material makeup, converted mechanical energy, vibration, to electrical energy. I quoted the work of other authors who claimed the Aswan granite, out of which the chamber was constructed, was composed of feldspar and up to 55% silicon quartz crystal. With the quartz crystal subject to vibration, I theorized the piezoelectric effect of the crystal was responsible for generating electron flow. Because the features and dimensions of the north shaft that make it suitable as a waveguide for microwave energy, I posited that the King's Chamber complex and its shaft connecting to the outside world would serve as a maser, microwave amplification through stimulated emission radiation. The key evidences to support this theory are the north shaft, with dimensions suitable for hydrogen radiation, and a bulbous opening in the south wall, shaped like a microwave horn antenna, that collected the amplified energy stimulated in the resonant King's chamber. However, with respect to the amount of quartz in the granite, I subsequently learned this claim was wrong. Not only was the idea that 100% of the quartz in the granite would generate electricity if stressed incorrect, but the quantity of quartz in the Aswan granite was less than what had been reported. In order for piezoelectricity to be a factor, quartz has to be stressed across a specific axis, and the random orientation of crystals in the granite does not support the idea that piezoelectricity was a significant factor, even if the quantity of quartz was 55%. Now, Christopher and I will be having a discussion about this soon, and it will be posted in my channel. Make sure to like and subscribe in order to catch it.
The face on Mars was real interesting. I got really into Richard Hoagland and all his Cydonia stuff for a while, but he was making some very bizarre measurements. Like if you go one half of the distance between this and three quarters of the way between that, it's exact number that it takes. But don't do that. How about don't do that? How about don't just fucking arbitrarily look for some sort of.
I did that in a video once, kind of being a dick, making fun of the idea that there's all this data encoded in the vases. I have no problem with the idea of the vases being like, you know, proof that these guys were, you know, they're definitely fucking exacting and whatnot. But the idea that they've like hidden data.
Is that the Cydonia face?
All right, here's a clip that I made that I was trying to like get out there before Jamie interrupted me. Thanks a lot, Jamie. I'm joking, of course, but conversations flow, right? But my point is that I was like, kind of trying to poke fun at the idea that, like, you know, you can just grab arbitrary numbers by random measurements and make things. Here you go.
The depth of a PS2 system is 7 inches. 7 times pi equals 21.9905. The length of the console is 11.75 inches. 21.9905 divided by 11.75 equals 1.8715. 1.8715 is a type of structural steel used to construct skyscrapers. The length of the system is 11.75 inches. The power switch in front is 0.5 inches long. The power switch in back is 0.625 inches long. Combined length of power switch is 1.125 inches. 11.75 plus 1.125 equals 12.875. 12.875 times the golden ratio of 1.618 gives a total of 20.83175. Almost exactly the number of hundreds of tons of steel used in the World Trade Center. Findings. Sony coded the structural steel and the amount used in the World Trade Center in the dimensions of the PlayStation 2 console. Conclusion. Sony did 9/11.
There are people in that are Atlantis hunters today. There's the guy, Robert Saphir. I hate to say his name even, but I will because he needs to be put on blast a bit. This guy he's an Atlantis bro. He thinks that the DNA story that we've been told out of Africa is wrong. Okay, fine, whatever. And this is this kind of constant digs at Africans, not out of Africa, but at Africa. They were all these different species bred with different hominids, and these guys bred with the stupid ones, and these other guys bred with smart ones, and these guys bred with strong ones. And it's like, it's racist, for lack of a better term. It might not even be what you would consider white supremacist, but it's definitely, when you're done with, if you were to take everything he said and accept it, you would walk away thinking that different groups of humans are clearly better than each other genetically, fucking hands down, and you can judge it based on skin.
Well, this turned out pretty much exactly as I expected. You got a bunch of Robert's friends running around in my comments going, "Oh, Dan's the same as Flint Dibble. He's a hypocrite." He's like, "Yeah, yes, there's no such thing as real racists because somebody falsely accuses somebody of being a racist. It just magically means there's no such thing." You fucking idiots. Anyway, I'll make a video soon that will explain in detail why I said what I said about that jackass named Robert. And let me be very clear here. Some of you might not like it. And there's the fucking door. Bye.
Most humans are like, what's the tallest guy ever? He's like 9 feet tall.
8'3". Okay. Robert Wadlow. I grew up in that near him, so.
So let's.
Okay, this is a bit, part's a bit embarrassing. Like, I did grow up in Brighton, Illinois, which is farm country, corn country. It's real close to Alton, Illinois. I went to Robert Wadlow's personal home like 3 or 4 times. I don't know, maybe 6 times as a kid, and in a museum. I remember when his glasses were stolen. Like when they first put up the statue, somebody ripped the glasses off of the brass statue. Point is, I am familiar with this site, but I fucked up. I said it was 8.3 inches. Said it confidently, and that's inaccurate. Joe was right. It's closer to 9 feet. It's 8'11". Robert Wadlow passed away at 8'11", not 8'3". Egg on Dan's face.
Well, only you would have a painting of you busting Shane Gillis's ass.
I didn't make that.
Every time he posts that picture, he's like, I had a great time on JRE. I'm like, man, I seen that. That's a beautiful work of art, right?
It's very pretty.
Very pretty. Good painting. Now, I'm more scientifically literate, I think, than most of the people that I know. So, and I kind of feel like Shane Gillis jokes about being nicked by the Down syndrome thing. I feel like I was nicked by that antisocial thing.
That's deceptive.
Yeah. And she missed out, man. She could have sat in the same chair that Shane Gillis sat in, right?
Like, yes. No, he sits in that one.
Explains the stains.
Or it could have been a wreck.
By the way, when I drew the parallel about us fighting, I don't want a picture of me next to Shane Gillis. Over there. Thank you very much. I'm good. don't need that.
So I've seen all kinds of comments that are like, oh, all roads lead back to Shane Gillis, or, well, this guy's gay for Shane Gillis. And, well, you know, man, of course I would get gay for Shane Gillis. We've all got somebody we'd get gay for, right? If the money was right and whatnot. And what I require would be like a couple of Nintendo 64 games, like a joint infused, obviously, and then like 2 episodes of season 3 of Tires. I get to be an extra that gets lines. I don't just like, I don't mean lines. I mean like I get to talk, right? So that would make me a little on the gay side for Shane Gillis. But, you know, here's the thing. I like stand-up comedy. I know it's crazy. I like comedy a lot. As a matter of fact, the Kill Tony stuff, I liked it before I even knew it was Joe Rogan's product, embarrassingly enough. When I saw him the first time, I had just found out that Kill Tony was a product of the comedy mothership. I had no fucking clue, right? So I asked Joe, I'm like, hey, man, would you, like, I really would have liked to have seen that, but I didn't get a chance to. And he's like, oh, dude, next time, let me know. I know it's always sold out, but next time, let me know. I'm like, you know, I didn't know you this time. I just met you, right? So this time when he texted me, he's like, hey, Dan, you want to come back to my podcast? I'm like, oh, hell yeah. By the way, is there a Kill Tony episode happening anytime around then? He's like, oh, yeah, that night, we can go to one. He said, we can go to one. And I was all excited, a little bit scared that I'd end up on the panel, but thankfully that didn't happen. But what did happen is I got to sit next to Joe, sat next to, and watch the show. And I'm not going to spoil the show. It was hilarious. I will tell you, the after party is nuts, okay? You go into a bar that's a small bar that's rented out for the VIPs only, and apparently that includes long-haired, weird-looking dudes like me. So I'm walking around this place talking to people, and most of the people there are like myself or like the other Kill Tony guys, where they're like recent bucket pulls. They're recent. They just made it, right? This isn't old to them. They're very thankful for the job that they have. They are very thankful for their opportunity they have been handed. And so you walk around that bar and the vibe is really chill. It's like more than chill. It's wholesome as fuck. As a matter of fact, the people that just were bucket pulls that night that made it, they got the golden ticket and they got to go in that VIP lounge. And 45 minutes before this were fucking dishwashers. Those guys' eyes were like the size of silver dollars, man. Like, I told one of them, hey, he was like, that's my hero over there. And I'm like, no, dude, that was your hero yesterday. That's your colleague now. And he was just like, oh, you're right. Oh, my God. that's the, that bar. It was beautiful. It was, everybody was so happy, so chill, just like it would, if a fight broke out there, it would be with fucking feathers and pillows. It was just so nice. Anyway, I had a really great time. And, you know, I've got an upcoming video about that Robert guy, and I've got some other stuff coming up soon, and you should check all that out. There's clips down below. I really apologize for taking this long to get a video out. You guys have to understand, you don't have to understand, but I would ask you to understand. 3 weeks of traveling, each time 2 to 3 days, my son is wrestling all this time. So I come back to Spokane, come back home, and it's immediate. The next day, wrestling. So I take him to school, drop him off, try to catch up on a little snooze and taking care of home stuff. And then my schedule has been very tight. And I apologize for that. I've got several videos in the works that I just haven't finished, because this is honestly the trickiest part. You kind of have to be in the right frame of mind. You kind of have to, everything has to be quiet. The world has to be in alignment. And then you can do this. So I apologize for it taking so long, but I promise you, I've got a couple of weeks before wrestling season gives way to baseball season. We got the 2-week window here. During that 2-week window, I'm going to upload like a madman, or at least get working on it so that they can come out afterwards. Love you guys. Thank you so much. I mean, I just got to go meet Joe Rogan again and talk to Tony Hinchcliffe and all these other guys. And it just really is thanks to... Everybody tells me it's thanks to my efforts. Yes, Dan, you're such a great part of the community. But honestly, I could be screaming at a wall if y'all didn't share, like, watch to the end. And so I thank you so much.